Tape 4 of The Inner Art of Meditation. We rejoin the third class on working with emotions and feelings with Jack Kornfield.
I'd like to talk about opening up the meditation a bit further than we work with the breath and all of the energies of the body so far, the sensations. Remember last week when I told the story of Nasruddin and the donkey, and that we often pay attention to our ideas about things rather than the donkey itself. Beside the body sensations that we encounter as we begin to pay attention or be more present, another aspect of life you could call part of the donkey is that we begin to see a play of moods or states of mind and feelings in the heart that change and determine very much our experience. So you sit and sometimes you're bored or you're restless or you're afraid or you're sleepy or you're happy or you're in love or you're depressed. And those states arise for us and color the whole of our world. So that if you're in a rotten mood, you wake up and you're angry and depressed and so forth, it almost doesn't matter who comes in the door or who you see, there's something wrong with them. There's something you won't like about them. Do you know those days?
Yes.
Similarly, if you're in love, which one of my teachers, if you've fallen in love, one of my teachers used to call it falling in the well, actually, but we won't go into that now. You can be driving along and have a car accident and say, oh, it's just my car, you know, it's all right. The sensibility, the feelings, the flavors of our mind and our heart have a very powerful effect on what our life is like, almost more than the circumstances themselves. Now, as we begin to do a deeper meditation practice and start to listen and come into the present, we see the movements of the heart and the feelings. And often what we initially encounter is difficult. Not always, but often it is. Just as initially there can be tension and sensations that have been held in the body that show themselves, so too in the mind. This is a poem from Kabir. He says, "Friend, please tell me what I can do about this world I hold to and keep spinning out." Kabir is an old ancient Indian poet and spiritual writer. "I gave up sewn clothes and wore a robe, but I noticed one day how well woven was its cloth. So I bought some burlap, but I still threw it elegantly over my left shoulder. I pulled back my sexual longings, and now I discover that I'm angry a lot. I gave up rage, and now I notice that I'm greedy all day. I worked hard at dissolving the greed, and now I'm proud of myself. When the mind wants to break its link with the world, it still holds on to something, one after another. Kabir said, listen, my friends, there are very few that find the path, yet it's right here in front of us." So these different states and difficulties will arise, and we get entangled in them over and over again. You can start to see that in your meditation. Your judgments, your fears, all those things. Evagrius, who was one of the Christian desert fathers, wrote a beautiful text in the 2nd century A.D. about the demons that attacked the meditators in the desert of the Sinai in Egypt. And they were the demons of desire and anger and pride and so forth. Sleepiness was called the noonday demon. Desire, I want to go back to Alexandria and have a pizza or whatever, souvlaki, whatever they sold in Alexandria. And then you get rid of those demons and you say, see how good I've done, and the demon of pride arises. So the next step is to begin to work with the different states which arise within us that determine our relationship to life as a part of the meditation itself. To take that which is here. Now, the Buddha gave, and as an example, five common difficulties, five common entangling or difficult energies. They correspond to the demons that were found by Evagrius in Egypt 1,800 years ago. They correspond to old Hindu texts, And quite interestingly enough, the same demons appear to live in Marin County, and they get around these fellows. So the first of these difficult energies, and these are samples because these are some of the hardest, but you will find many others that I'll talk about. The first of the common difficulties you encounter is desire. What's wrong with desire? We like desire. I mean, desire runs our life. We want things and then we get them. Why is it difficult? Desire for pleasant tastes or sounds or experiences or sensations. The problem with desire, there are a lot of meanings for it. In one way, there's desire that is simply the motivation to act that can be compassionate or wise. In this specific case, desire means what I translate as the if-only mind. It's the wanting mind that wants what's not here. If only I had one of those nice round zafus, or if I had one of those little meditation benches, then I could really meditate right. Or if only I had time to sit in the morning instead of going to work, or if only I could sit in the evening, or if only I had eaten, then this would be a better sitting. Or if only I hadn't eaten, you know? Or if only I was older, you know? I'm too young to do this. I've got a lot of things to finish up. Or if only I'd started when I was younger. I'm too old. Or if only I had the right relationship, someone to love me, then I could do my spiritual practice. Or if only I had more money or the right job. Do you know the if-only mind? And the problem with the if-only mind is that when it arises, it believes that what we seek deeply to make us complete is someplace else, when actually all we ever have is sight, sound, smells, taste, and physical and mental perception. It's here already. But we think, no, if I had that, then I will be satisfied. Does it work? What happens? You get it, and then what? You want the next thing, because there is no end to desire. So you're sitting and wanting comes. If you get caught up in it, forget it. You're just lost and you get up and you order a pizza again, or you eat something, or you entertain yourself. So that's the desiring mind. Oscar Wilde put it this way. He said, I can resist anything but temptation. Right? And our society fools us. It says, if you get enough of this fast enough, I think I talked about this a couple of weeks ago, you know, if you have a beautiful dinner out and a good movie and great sex and a good night's sleep and a good jog in the morning and a fresh croissant and the right car, and you do it all fast enough, you'll be happy. And really what happens is if you do it that fast, you get tired after a while. You just can't keep it up. The good life becomes ridiculous. Because what we seek is not what's outside. What we seek is something in our heart, in our inner sense, in our inner being. Now, how can we work with this? You sit and desire arises. How do you work with it in meditation? The same way we work with the sensations. If you work with it by suppressing it, is that any good? Not very useful. I mean, when you suppress stuff, what happens is it comes out some other place. Because it's part of us. So you don't want to suppress it. On the other hand, you don't want to act it out. You don't? Well, if you are like me and you acted out all of your desires and all the rest of that stuff in there, they would lock you up if you're like a normal person, right? So you don't want to suppress it and you don't want to act all of it out. Neither of those is good. What's left is instead to begin to use it for insight or understanding, to learn from it, to find some freedom in relationship to it. So desire arises and you sit. And here, you name it. You say, wanting, wanting, or desire, desire, and you feel it. What's it like? If it's hunger, is the belly hungry, or the tongue, or the mind, or the heart? Often we eat, but really it's our hearts lonely. So you begin to study what the force of desire is like that runs most of the world. For the first time, we're going to not just fulfill it, but sit and feel it, and see its nature, watch it come, feel what it's like in the body, name it, desire, desire, desire. And after a while, what will happen? Guaranteed. Eventually, it will pass away. And then you'll see the next thing that comes. And you begin to see its impermanent nature, that you don't have to act on every thought or desire. Then you could choose. You have a different possibility, different freedom. Now in retreats, we have something that's called the Vipassana romance, where people will sit. They're all quiet and silent for 10 days and not supposed to look at one another. And then you notice out of the corner of your eye this form of this person, kind of attractive, you know, but you're not looking, right? And you go and you sit and you imagine maybe meeting that person at the end of the retreat, talking with them, perhaps going off and meditating together or something like that, you know. And before you know it, you're married with kids, maybe divorced, and you've watched the whole thing. And you've never even looked at this person in the eye. The capacity of wanting is very deep in us. So here you're going to study it instead of just being lost in it. Now, its opposite is the second of these difficult energies. And then instead of wanting, this is aversion, irritation, resistance, not liking, anger, ill will. It also includes some related states. Judgment. Has anyone noticed judgment in their mind? It's a kind of aversion. I don't like this. That's no good. You're doing it wrong. It includes fear. I don't want to feel this. I don't like this. It's a resistance. It includes boredom. Boredom says, I don't want what's here. I don't want to experience this. I want some other experience than what God has provided me in this moment. All of those are the states of resistance. And again, it becomes difficult to work with if we get caught in them. It becomes difficult to continue to meditate. And just like there is a Vipassana romance, there is as well at retreats something we call the Vipassana Vendetta, where you can sit and there's somebody in that room that bothers you. They walk wrong, they eat wrong, you never talk to them, but they're wrong, right? And so you can have this whole fantasy of what you're going to do to them or why they are that way. And again, you've never even met this person. So you begin to work with this. And the way to work with it, again, the key strategy is to begin to face it. We have acted on our desire so long unconsciously without understanding it. We've acted on our fear or our anger or our judgment. So here when it comes, instead, you embrace it. And if you're angry, then you be angry. And you sit there and you note, angry, angry. Feel what is it like in the body. There's heat. It does a certain thing to the breath. There's a certain energy. Is it pleasant? Is it unpleasant? Is desire pleasant? You really look and see, is desire pleasant or is it painful? Quite an interesting study to see. Is anger pleasant? Is it painful? You begin to look at it and you name it, the name being a way to stay with it. As long as it's present, you note it. Now, we get really caught in the stories about things. And that's why we get angry. We think the world should be a particular way for us. Do you know the story of the Chinese man who's in a village, and he has a wife and son and daughter and a beautiful horse? Everyone says he's so lucky and he's the most prosperous man because he has a cart that the horse pulls and they can plow the fields and so forth. One day the horse runs away and they say, oh, he's so unfortunate. He had been fortunate, now he's unfortunate. He says, maybe. And wouldn't you know it, but a week later, the horse comes back and brings with it a wild stallion. Two horses, he's so fortunate. He says, maybe. He sends his son out to train the stallion to break it in, and in doing so, trying to ride it, the son falls off and breaks his leg badly. Your son in China is everything. He's so unfortunate, his son may limp and may not heal properly. It's such a shame what happened. He says, maybe. A couple weeks later, the emperor's army comes through town, recruiting all the young men to go fight against the barbarians. That's the war we're still fighting these days, right? And all the young men can go except one, of course, who's still healing from falling off the horse. And they say, oh, he's so fortunate. His son didn't go. And we could continue with the story. You get the point. We don't know. We have so many opinions about what is good and what's not. We just don't know. And sometimes what's not good is the very lesson we need. So in some way, what's needed when you really study anger deeply, beside an acceptance of it and an understanding, which we're doing through the awareness, is a very deep movement of forgiveness. Because how do we know why this comes? And our opinions are really so temporal, they're so short. Now, fear is an interesting one. Most of us, when we're afraid, we just get afraid. When you meditate and fear arises, it's the same process. You sit and you note fear, fear, and you feel it. What's it like in your body? The breath, the body sensation. But what does it do in the mind? Does it make the mind smaller or bigger? You face fear. Mullah Nasruddin said at one point, there's the story, he said, at one time I caused a whole tribe of Bedouins to run. And a friend said, well, how exactly did you do that, these wild, bloodthirsty Bedouins? He said, it was simple. I ran and they all ran after me. And this is a lot of the way that fear works. The farther we run, the faster the fear comes to follow us. So in this case, you're just going to sit, and fear comes and you note fear. Fear, 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 and you just feel it. And what happens is after practicing for a while, maybe after 80 times or 250 times, fear will arise, you'll get afraid, you'll see what it does in the body, you'll note fear, feel, you'll be scared, and then one day you'll be sitting and fear comes, and you'll feel it, and you'll note fear, fear, and then it'll come the sense, oh, this is fear, I know you, hi, welcome. And it's as if the fear becomes one of your friends, because you've let yourself relate with attention to this that we usually run away from. So anger, fear, judgment, we'll talk about judgment more next week as well. Beginning to pay attention. Now, one thing about labeling the moods and emotions that come, if you pay attention and you label them kind of gently, fear, 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 anger, desire, whatever it happens to be, you will discover that they don't last very long. Thoughts come quickly. Thoughts generally just, you know, one follows another. It can be just a few seconds. Body sensations tend to be a little slower. Moods are in the middle. And for the most part, feelings last, oh, there are two or three per minute. If you label it, rarely will a feeling last more than 15 labels. And then some other feeling will come. You see, you try it. Now, there are two more difficult energies that are paired just like wanting and avoiding that are common. The next two, in Sanskrit, tinamitta is translated sloth and sluggishness, torpor, sleepiness. That's one side, and its opposite, which is restlessness. So you sit, and has anyone noticed that you feel sleepy sometimes? Again, it's a very powerful state. So what can you do with this? The first thing is you can begin to pay attention and not judge it or be afraid of it. Say, what does this sleepiness feel like, and what is it here to teach me? Sleepiness arises actually from three causes. First, it comes when you're tired. And a lot of people live lives that are hectic and often quite out of balance. And you sit in meditation and you get really sleepy and your body is telling you something. Give me some rest. Live in a saner way. Listen to it. It's, you know, it's smart. It's got something to tell you. Pay attention to it. So one thing is that it's simply a voice to respect from your body. Now, two other causes for sleep to arise. The second is sleepiness can come from being calm or concentrated. You start to feel your breath, you get a bit quieter, and all of a sudden you notice you're sleepy. It comes because the mind gets steady or quiet, and there isn't much energy. We're not used to being quiet and awake. You start to get concentrated or calm, and it's as if the mind says, gee, it's quiet in here, it must be bedtime. And it puts itself to sleep. Because our culture is such that we're generally only awake when the radio's on, and the movie's playing, and the drama's happening. And we don't live in such a way that we know how to be still and awake. And it's a wondrous thing to be able to do. But we don't know that. So part of the art of meditation is learning how to be still and bring a sensitivity and awareness to that. So that's the second reason. And with that, you can sit up straight, open your eyes, bring a little more energy, as well as pay attention to it. Now, the third reason sleepiness comes is interesting, is as a resistance. Sometimes you'll be sitting, and all of a sudden, some pain or some grief or some fear or something that's difficult will come, and you'll find yourself getting very sleepy, and you're not tired at all. You know that kind of sleepiness. It comes, the mind says, ooh, I don't want to feel this, let's go to sleep. So you might listen when sleep comes and ask, is there something cooking? Is that why it's there? Or am I sleepy? Or whatever. And then in seeing that, you can work with it. The way to work is first to notice, sleepy, sleepy, and pay attention so that you learn about that part of yourself, that energy, how it feels in the body and what it does. If you've labeled it for a while and you're still sleepy, then you can open your eyes or sit up straight or walk more briskly. I had a lot of sleepiness in my practice. My teacher had me walk backwards in the woods at night to stay awake. And then I'd still sit and I'd kind of fall, not asleep. So he said, all right, for you, you go sit on the edge of the well. Right? There's a well near your cottage. You sit there. And I did. And I'd start to nod in 50 feet of space, the adrenaline rush. But, all right. The fear will keep me awake. So it's workable. You can work with it. You note it, and then if it's necessary, you bring a bit more energy. Now, its opposite is restlessness, worry. The same thing, what do? You feel restless, your body's restless, you can't stand it, it's too hard, you got to get up, vibration inside. You sit there and you note, restless, restless. We are so conditioned that when difficult things come, we get restless or lonely or bored, what do? We get up and we open the refrigerator, or we turn on the TV, or we call someone on the phone, or we distract ourselves. And so our whole life is running away from certain basic states of loneliness or boredom or restlessness or fear. Finally, in meditation, you're going to stop and find a place of greatness, of strength, of your being. So restlessness comes, you just label it, restless, restless, and feel what it's like. Now, what if it's really strong? What do then? With sleepiness, you open your eyes, or you stand up. You can meditate standing up, or you walk. With restlessness, what you do is you die. You sit there and you say, okay, kill me, take me. And see what it does. You die of restlessness. Be the first yogi in Marin County to die of restlessness. And what happens in that moment where you say, all right, let me die of restlessness, take me, is that it all changes if you really do that. And it just kind of moves in some way. Because what makes these states so powerful is our resistance to them. And the moment you say, all right, let me die of it, it's not so bad. It doesn't have the same impact. It's the resistance to it that makes it so difficult. The fifth common energy is doubt. It's too hard. I can't do it. Everybody else can meditate but me. I can't concentrate, it's hard to sit still, it's the wrong time, again, I'm too young, I'm too old, maybe it's not the right practice, I should do something more entertaining, Sufi dancing or something, this is too boring, you know? Or I want one of those Tibetan lamas, those guys in robes and so forth, I don't want an American teacher, I want one of those gurus or something like that, you know. So it's doubts about yourself or the practice or the time and so forth, and the minute you believe it, you get caught in it. You cannot continue to pay attention. So what do? It comes, and again, you know, doubt, doubt, doubting, paying attention to it and letting it be part of the meditation. There are really two kinds of doubt. That's the small doubt. I can't do it, it's too hard, it's the wrong day, and so forth. You just label that. There's also something called the great doubt, which is the deeper questioning of who am I or what is the nature of this heart and mind and consciousness that we're given. And this is the doubt or questioning that brings us to realization or understanding. There's a story which illustrates this from the Sufi tradition. There was a master who went to heaven and appeared at the pearly gates. There was an angel with a sword who said, go no further, O mortal, until you can prove to me your worthiness for entering into this paradise. And the master responded to him, how do I know this is a real heaven and that you're a real angel and this is not just the delusions of my disordered mind undergoing the process of death? And before the angel could reply, a voice from inside the gates called out, "Let him in, he's one of us." This is the great doubt. This is the doubt that is not, I can't do it or it's too hard, but the doubt of what is true? Who am I? What can I really value? How can I live this life from the deepest place of my being or my heart? What is the meaning of living in freedom or liberation? And that's a valuable part of our practice. So I hope you can see that what we're beginning to do is work with all of the moods of the heart and mind. As you sit, not just these difficulties, but love, happiness, bliss, rapture will also arise. You can note that. Love, love, happiness, happiness, rapture, bliss. The point is not to suppress, but to open to what's there with awareness, with wisdom, and with kindness. We've cut ourselves off from so much in life, and we begin to understand this through the process of meditation and paying attention. Now, as you sit, also you'll discover, as I mentioned, not just tensions in the body, but tensions of the heart. There is very commonly unfinished business that will arise. If you have grief or sorrow, if you have loss, if you have forgiveness to do, if there's things that you still hold on to, all that will come. And you need to be able to sit and weep or note the grief. Let the heart open as it will. It's a difficult journey if you want to open, but the point of the journey is of opening, and the difficulties, in fact, are the journey. Most people think that if I get rid of these, then I can really meditate. And these are the meditation. These are what one Zen master called manure for Bodhi, manure for enlightenment. You plow them under and it enriches your practice. It keeps the practice juicy and alive. There's one last story I want to tell as a way to illustrate working with this. I read an article recently in a magazine about parents who had started a network for disabled children. They'd been unable to have their own child, and so decided, rather than going through all the medical stuff, to adopt a baby. Since white Caucasian babies are hard to find, they looked to adopt a baby from a poor third world country. Went to India, adopted a child from South India, from a very poor area, and brought him home and loved him, but something was wrong. And after 6 months, they discovered that he had cerebral palsy and that he was profoundly deaf. And it was very sad and painful. The child would never walk. And what they did is they started to teach him sign language so he could hear through the words of their hands. They learned it themselves and they taught him. And then they got him a little wheelchair so he could move around in. And then they rode away to India, where he came from, and they asked to adopt a second child. And they requested, "Please, could we have another child who is deaf to keep this one company?" An astonishing story. Here they had the most difficult situation. Parents with a child with cerebral palsy, paralyzed and deaf. And most of us would feel sorry for ourselves and feel all the struggle. What they did is they looked up and they said, "Please, I'll take a second one, thank you." An incredible spirit of acceptance of difficulty and working with it as part of the spirit of practice. What's important to realize is that it's not so much what we have or what experiences come to us in this life, but how we relate to them that creates our happiness or our sorrow, that creates fear or compassion. There's a good story from Mullah Nasruddin again that illustrates this. At one point, he was walking on the road and he saw an old man carrying a bag. This old man had retired, he'd had a fine life with his family and children and grandchildren, but he got bored and he wanted to travel around the world and find something new. He traveled around and he discovered there wasn't really much new, and he got more and more depressed seeing that everything was just how it was. And he was kind of walking down the road moping, and Nasruddin stopped him. And he told him his story. And he said, so I have all of what's valuable with me here in this bag, and I'm looking around for new experiences, but the world is just the way it is. Nasruddin, seeing his depression, reached out and grabbed the bag and took it from him and ran off in the woods. The man was quite dismayed and walked further down the road, yet more depressed. Nasruddin cut through the woods, knowing the territory, and came out on the road further down, where he placed the bag in the center of the road and then hid behind a tree. Some minutes later, the man came walking down the road, more dejected and depressed than ever, really unhappy. He'd lost all his precious possessions. Then he sees the bag. He runs up to it and opens it, and all the valuables are still in it. And he starts laughing and jumping for joy. And Nasruddin steps from behind the tree and says, strange what it takes to make some people happy. He had the same thing before as he did afterward. That's true in our life. What matters is not what we have. I promise you that. But how we relate to it. So somebody on this earth has to learn that. Because the forces of greed and hatred and so forth are so great. We're going to start to look at that. Let your eyes close as you sit. Your body comfortable again and erect, stable. Now the instructions will be to continue working with the breath as the center object, feeling it as carefully as you can, the actual sensations of the breath, the nose or belly or wherever. If body sensations are strong and call your awareness, then name them: itching, tingling, hot, cold, pain, pain. If sounds arise and interrupt you, there's a loud car or someone coughs, then you can note those. Hearing, not the story or whether they're good or bad, but the bare act of hearing, until it passes away and then back to the breath. If any strong moods or feelings, love, fear, desire, anger, contentment, restlessness, doubt, bliss. If any strong moods arise, when they come, let go of the breath, feel them quite fully, experience what this is like, wanting, rapture, fear, naming them softly, fear, as long as it's present, staying with it as long as it's there. When the feeling goes away, then returning back to the next breath, being centered with the breath, the body, sounds, and the movements of the heart. stay in the present. If the mind wanders off, come back to the breath, sensations, or the moods and feelings. Keep the labeling very simple. Let the naming be just 5% in the background. Simple name. Mostly feel what is present, opening yourself to it with a careful, gentle awareness. Notice what's present just now. for the last couple of minutes of this sitting, let go of the breath, continue to pay attention, but shift your attention to note whatever feeling is present, even if it's quite subtle or mood. If it's peaceful, label it peaceful, peaceful. If it's restless, note restless. Sad or happy, whatever mood is present now, name it softly and see how long it lasts. How many labels? And then when it is past, name the next feeling present. After peaceful, it might turn to calm, or sadness might turn to fear. Notice the next mood.
This concludes Side A. Please turn the tape over for Side B.